to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. This year's race for lieutenant governor is drawing a lot of attention. It's a contest where House Republican leader Don Turner is challenging one-term incumbent David Zuckerman. What will be some of the key issues in this race? Well, joining us in the studio right now is Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. It's part of VPR's continuing coverage of campaign 2018. Great to have you back on the program.
Glad to be here, Bob. Thank you.
I do want to mention that GOP candidate Don Turner was a guest on Vermont Edition on Monday, and you can listen to that interview by going to vpr.net and clicking on Vermont Edition. And also, VPR and Vermont PBS will be hosting a lieutenant governor's debate. That'll be taking place on Wednesday, October 10th at noon. It's part of our new debate series. David, you've served as Vermont's lieutenant governor for 2 years. What do you consider to be your most important achievement in office?
Well, it's an interesting question. And Bob, thank you. And listeners, thank you for being with us today. When I went into the office of lieutenant governor, I was talking about a number of issues that I thought were important: a rural economy, universal health care, water quality, and a number of those issues. And ultimately, as lieutenant governor, you don't actually have a hand on the policy making. That's truly up to the legislators in the House and Senate. And then, of course, the governor, either signature or pushing bills one way or another. One of the things that I found very fascinating as lieutenant governor is actually working all across the state, frankly, to rebuild people's faith in our democracy. With the night that I got elected was the same night that Donald Trump got elected. And as people may know, he's the least supported in Vermont than he is of any state in the country. And people are really worried about the tenor of Congress and things in Washington. And I go around talking with people about what we do have here in Vermont, the accessibility people have to the process, bringing more people into the process. I've put out a newsletter every few weeks during the session that delves into issues, goes out to tens of thousands of Vermonters, and folks can sign up for that at ltgov.vermont.gov if they're interested. I've reached out to Republican and Democratic and progressive cohorts in the Senate and said, do you want to put something in that newsletter to say, you know what, in this office and in all offices, frankly, once we are elected, our job is to serve everyone and get information out about the issues and let people decide what's right. So I've done a lot of work to reach out to folks from the different parties to make sure their voices are a part of what I put out across the state. I've had a FaceTime town hall once a week with different groups for about half an hour, from the Alzheimer's group, Black Lives Matter, minimum wage, really discussing the issues so people can get a little more depth and not just the soundbite world of politics. I think right now, as much as I would want to say, oh, I made some bill pass, really, that's not the role of lieutenant governor. The role of lieutenant governor is really to be an ambassador for democracy and make sure people are a part of the process, and ultimately to run the Senate in a fair and impartial manner when interpreting the rules of the body. And I think across the spectrum, senators would generally agree that I've done that.
Let's take a look at health care as one of the first issues. You're a strong proponent of a government-financed health care system that would provide care to all Vermonters. What do you say to those folks who argue that it's just not realistic for Vermont to do this on its own because it's too complicated and would dramatically increase tax burdens?
Well, I think it's important whenever the rhetoric gets started in terms of it'll increase tax burdens. Well, it'll also eliminate premiums. It'll eliminate a number of expenses, and it would create and find a number of efficiencies. So it's the overall cost of the program that one has to look at, not just how it's paid for. I heard a number of business owners a couple of years ago saying, well, we can't go forward with this. The 10 or 11 or 12% payroll tax would be too high. And oftentimes I would ask them, what are you currently paying as a percentage of your payroll to cover your employees with their health care? And they would say, well, I don't know. And so, well, the first question before arguing whether 10, 11, or 12% is too high is to look at your own books and see if you're already spending 10 or 11 or 12% to provide the health care coverage that you're providing your employees. And I recognize a lot of small business owners, including my own business as a farm, we don't provide health insurance. We can't do that. And many can't. But if we all were in it together, just like we're all in our law enforcement support together, our schools, you name it, there's a number of public service scenarios where everybody pitches in, We get a more efficient outcome for our dollars, and everybody gets that service.
Is the way to start down that path to have primary care for everybody?
Well, I think that's seriously being looked at, and I think it's important to look at that, whether it's primary care for everybody, expanding Medicare for all. I think all of these need to be explored. I will certainly indicate I am not the expert on this, but what we do have is amazing experts all across the state, from doctors to administrators to others, and that's who needs to be at the table to have this discussion.
Today in the program, our guest is Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. If you've got a thought, a question, give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You know, folks talk about Medicare for all as a possibility, but even Medicare, a lot of people who have Medicare have to buy a private supplemental policy. It doesn't cover everything that they need it to cover. So wouldn't you run into the same problem if you had Medicare for all?
Well, you know, if everybody got essential health care and primary health care and many of the things that Medicare does provide, we would be moving vastly forward compared to where we are. And obviously, Vermont's better than most states. We expanded our Medicaid program under the Affordable Care Act and others, and we have some of the highest coverage out there. But it's still a hodgepodge. You still spend 10 to 20% of our healthcare dollars on the paperwork of collecting money from insurance agents. Both my spouse and I have had different medical ailments over the last few years. And you get the bills from the hospital, and it's gobbledygook. And in part, that's all of these contortions that we have in our bill payment systems and so forth that truly have to be the most inefficient Rubik's Cube of system. And if you have a universal system and we simplify it, we could use those savings to get more health care to more people. Certainly, Medicare is not perfect either, but in general, people are pretty darn happy with it.
Let me ask you about Act 46. Many school districts around the state are being asked to merge as a way to help reduce education costs and provide greater educational opportunities for their students. But some communities, and there's one in central Vermont, do not want to merge. They're talking lawsuits now, and they're going to find out in November if the State Board of Education is going to mandate that those mergers and if legal action is going to be necessary. Should towns be required to merge if they don't want to and they voted not to?
Well, that's a great question. And just for background, I was on the Senate Education Committee when Act 46 passed. And we very clearly put into that bill what we called an off-ramp or an appeal process, where if you are a geographically isolated community, your spending is within reason, your outcomes are good, and you can make a reasonable argument that you made an attempt to work with neighboring communities to find a merger that would work, and that fell through and didn't work out, then you would have the opportunity to make this appeal to the State Board of Education. And that's the process we're in now. I've talked with a number of folks. I had a meeting up in Franklin County prior to my opponent's meeting with those same folks to talk about how Act 46 was supposed to work, what their concerns are in these towns, and they're very valid concerns in a number of them. In some of them, it's a vocal minority. In others, it's a very real conundrum where the length of time folks are going to have to be on the bus or whatnot really isn't a benefit, especially in the winter. So the process does have to carry itself out. I met with the head of the Agency of Education. I wrote a letter to the State Board of Education head, Krista Hewling, and said, what is your process? Because a lot of folks are feeling like the process that the State Board is carrying out has been very unclear and too short a timeline in terms of their opportunities to make their case. And I think those are valid arguments. And we need to make sure the State Board follows the intent of the law, which I think probably for about half to two-thirds of these communities would say, no, you have justifiable reasons to remain an individual district. At the same time, talking to those folks up in the Franklin County who are from all over the state at the time, I said, you know, you have to be aware that when the mantra comes out of political leadership, like my opponent and others, spending's too high, spending's too high, spending is too high, and people in your communities vote for these people over and over and over again, that puts pressure on the political system, which is how it's supposed to work, to do something. And this is the outcome. And so sometimes folks have to look at what they've got and say, am I really doing my own self good putting folks into office that are creating the pressure to say, squeeze spending, instead of really looking at how are our school systems working? Where is the spending? Which, in my opinion, and I've talked with many people, is primarily in social services in the schools. Let's look to save money there by saying, we have human services with a $2.4 billion budget in state government, education with a $1.7 billion expense in our state. They're both providing social services to these kids. Is there a way to blend those two arenas, create a better flow of service, and save money? Yes, there is, but that's going to take work and effort. It's not just a quick soundbite, I'm going to save you money. And that's the issue in Vermont, is are we going to do the work or are we just going to soundbite politic?
So how do you decide when a school is simply too small to continue to operate efficiently and provide the kind of programs that students need? I mean,
right.
If a high school has 45 students, a high school, the entire school has 45 students, is that too small?
Well, I won't say that I'm the expert on that. And Act 46 wasn't about closing an individual school because it's too small. In fact, most of the mergers that have occurred, they put language in there to protect those small schools from being iced right out because they don't have enough votes on the new board. Where the savings from Act 46 are supposed to be created is actually in the administrative side of the equation, not in closing schools. And we've seen that. How many schools have been forced to shut, and yet we're seeing school budgets get reined in a bit because we've seen those savings on the administrative side. So I think it's a little bit of a sidetrack to say these schools have to be closed, because that's not the intent of Act 46. That's not written in there at all. And in fact, communities under mergers can protect their small schools, but they can actually add the services in their school, because if you're in part of a larger district, you could have someone who's, say, a Spanish teacher, which for a 45-person high school, you might not be able to afford. But if you've got, you know, two or three schools together in your district, they could teach Spanish in middle school in one town one day, another town another, and in the high school on a third. And that way, some of those kids would get more access to programs, not less, if you had these larger districts.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tim, who is calling from Ferrisburg. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just had a quick comment. I hope it's not too late to comment on the healthcare debate.
Oh, not at all.
Go for it.
My only comment is, having worked in that field for over 15 years now and worked on proposals to the state and as a navigator for the exchange, as well as the private sector, I would only caution that I think the state is ill-equipped to step in into an insurance role, but that as a guiding sort of to look at something that's actually working in insurance markets, and I rarely hear this reference, but that the FDIC, when you walk into a bank, the FDIC is a federal agency that's reinsuring the bank.
That's right.
And that I rarely hear that that's talked about, where these insurance companies are buying reinsurance, and why the Fed doesn't step in and let the state step in the same role, where the public isn't dealing directly with them. Instead, the private insurers are working with the claims administration, and the state comes in just like the FDIC. The only other plan that would be similar to that would be extending Medicare down and dropping the age limit on Medicare that I can see. But anyway, that was my comment. I hope that they come up with some other alternative plans, and I wish them all the best in that.
Sure.
Okay, Tim, thanks very much. When we talk about Medicare for All, are you thinking that it's a system that everybody is going to participate in that system, or people have an opportunity to join that system, but if they want to stay with a private health insurance company, they can actually do that?
Well, when you look at different models of universal health care, it breaks down. It's true in schools as well. As more people break out of the system and go into little pockets where they have the money to go elsewhere, you end up having the pool of folks in the system often be disproportionate with respect to prior health issues or other circumstances, and that's what drives up the cost. Part of universal systems is everybody's in. We all know someday we're going to have to utilize the healthcare system. It's pretty rare that you're not going to have to, unless you have an unfortunate, very sudden end in your life. But the reality is, Some of us will use it more. Some will use it less. But it's a complete roulette wheel as to who happens to break a leg in a soccer game versus not, or who happens to fall walking up the stairs. And, you know, we do that with our fire service. We do that with our law enforcement. Most of us obviously hope our house never burns down. But we pay our local taxes to pay for the volunteer fire trucks, you know, departments, fire trucks. We pay our local taxes for those services. And that's what we're talking about here. Everybody in.
Let's talk to David in Brattleboro. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks, Bob. I'd like to ask the candidate if he would support the State Board of Education forcing merger on school districts that have created a viable alternative governance structure and where the communities overwhelmingly voted against merger. Would he support that forced merger?
David, that's a great question. Now,
right.
You know,
and I think he asked it a couple days
ago. You did,
but absolutely. I know David. Hello.
You know, there are a lot of people who wonder, okay, there's an appeals process. That's great. So towns or districts appeal to the State Board of Education. What happens if the State Board of Education says, sorry, we've looked at this situation and you need to merge? Is that the bottom line?
Well, the way the law is written at the moment, it is. Of course, as you brought up, there's the legal question that some folks have raised, and that always goes to the courts to be determined. But there's no doubt if a community has a very strong argument to make, I think they can and should bring it to the legislature. Ultimately, all of these mergers take time, and if these are declared in November, legislature returns in January. There's no doubt that the legislature and the education committees could have hearings on those handfuls of communities that feel they were unjustly forced to merge or don't like the merger that was presented by the state board. That's a fair conversation to have, and that's what the process is designed for. So, if there's a forced merger, there are those two remedies. Go to the courts and see what the courts find, and go to the legislature and see what the legislature finds. And I think it's a perfectly reasonable question and one that the legislature should take up, depending on those various factors.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're going to go back and talk to Rob in Richmond. Hey, Rob.
I had a quick question for the Lieutenant Governor about his stance on water quality issues in the state, specifically around the Lake in Crisis legislation and the attention that Lake Carmi had last year with the extensive blue-green algae bloom that we have. We're trying to work really, really hard locally in the Lake Carmi watershed and the Franklin watershed, and just wanted to get the Lieutenant Governor's opinion about what initiatives specifically he would address to clean up the state's waters as well as the waters at Lake Carmi.
Well, thank you, Rob. That's a great question. I've been a longtime advocate when I served on the Agriculture Committee in the Senate. We put forth a funding plan that was approximately $25 for any parcel. It was a parcel fee program where $25 for any parcel under 25 acres and $1 per acre above that. And that was a way to draw some resources from the larger landholders, and partly those are the farmers, but not squeeze them so hard that it continues to push them out of business the way they are right now with their low milk prices. Right now, the legislature, and particular, frankly, the governor, has really been the roadblock to adequately funding what we need to do with water quality. And there's really three main issues out there. One is the urban combined sewer overflow, which I think we heard a news clip on that earlier about Moreau Weinberger and the city of Burlington and others trying to figure out how to stop those combined sewer overflows. We have agricultural runoff is an issue, and we actually have impervious surfaces, so roads, rooftops, et cetera. So a lot of the urban areas also contribute. And we have to tackle all three of these head on. I've got a 12-year-old daughter. When you go to the beach and you can't swim in it, whether it's Lake Carmi, parts of Lake Champlain, and other bodies of water around the state, that's not only bad for us and our community, but it's also bad for our tourism. You know, it's only going to take a few more years of these kinds of bad stories to really put a crimp on the number of people that want to come to Vermont to recreate. This is a hugely consequential issue, and every year that it gets kicked the can down the road, we're really jeopardizing our own water, our own lives in terms of lifestyle, and our tourism industry.
Now, if the governor was sitting here right now, he would say that the administration is addressing this issue, that there is money in the short term to deal with water quality cleanup, and that he thinks it's premature to have a revenue source to provide money, let's say, 3, 4, 5, 6 years out, because there may be a different landscape at that point and other revenue opportunities. Is he wrong?
Well, I do think he's wrong. We need to be going full tilt on this. I don't think all the different scenarios are being addressed as quickly as they can. There are municipalities far beyond Burlington that have these combined sewer overflow problems. There are dairies that are really struggling and can't come up with the match money right now with the low milk price to do the remedies that they need to do on their farms. So every year that we go by not addressing this full on, we are leaving sort of pollution on the table, as it were. And so I do disagree. And I'll tell you, I took a phone call from someone who was very frustrated back a few months ago saying, I can't believe this overflow happening in Burlington polluting our water. And I said, well, do you know that? Now you know that, because the legislature passed a law to say the cities and municipalities have to divulge that information within 24 hours. So it's been happening for a long time, but now you know about it. And the point of that was to actually get folks like him and others who do care to speak up, because when people speak up, that's when we address the problems in the political process. And I said to him, I don't know, you know, what you make for money. He's a relatively younger Vermonter. He was in his low 30s, I believe. And he said, you know, I make $17 an hour. And I said, well, an idea was, you know, $20 or $30 per person to increase the speed with which we're doing this work, because it is expensive. And he said, you know, I have a hard time paying my bills, but I would happily pay $20 to $30 to move towards cleaner water in our state.
Isn't that part of the issue? Do you think the solution to this is that everybody in the state of Vermont has to pay something for lake cleanup, if it's a per parcel fee or whatever mechanism you use, that it's regardless of where you live? You may not have a lot of waterways near you or lakes or streams, but you're still going to contribute to part of the solution. Is that the idea?
Well, yes. And the issue is different in different parts of the state, right? So the caller, I think it was Rob, called in about, you know, Lake Carmi, and obviously in Lake Champlain, there's a lot of issues with the cyanobacteria and phosphorus. Well, in the Connecticut River watershed, it's nitrogen in the water. So there's issues almost everywhere in the state. And, you know, that's why all in. And that was the mantra a few years ago. And I think those of us that really want to see it get done believe that's the best way to go. Because if you start saying, well, this group doesn't have to pay or that group doesn't have to pay, then everybody starts raising their hand and saying, I'm the one that shouldn't have to pay. And you start having that battle versus keeping your eye on the target of, let's make sure our water in Vermont is cleaner and better for all of our children and each of our lives for the rest of our lives, and not be fighting with each other over, well, you're more righteous than I as far as how little damage you're doing. We're all doing our part, driving our cars, drinking milk, eating food. Those are things everybody does. So maybe not everybody drinks milk, but pretty much everybody eats food. And so it's all part of it.
And are you thinking that something like $25 million a year needs to be allocated for this problem over the next 10 or 20 years?
You know, I'm not the expert, but those are the numbers, as you know, that people have been bringing up, the scientists, the folks that are engineers in these arenas that know the work that needs to get done. That is the discussion. I mean, this problem was created over decades. It's not going to be solved overnight, but by delaying it, we're only compounding the problem.
Let's talk to Andy, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. Nice to talk to you, David.
Absolutely.
I've got another follow-up on Act 46. You probably figured out Brattleboro is one of the towns struggling.
Sure.
We've struggled with this for several years, and I love your opening comments that one of your key goals is this theme of rebuilding democracy. And that's beginning to emerge as a real issue here.
Right, with the votes.
The simple question is, why doesn't a duly warned vote after a two-year public discussion count?
Well, it does count. And part of the criteria of those, that off-ramp I talked about, I think it's Section 9 or something to that number on the bill, includes the community perspective with respect to the votes. And, you know, I did not originate the idea of Act 46. In fact, as I said earlier, this has all come about because of that economic pressure, the affordability discussion, the no taxes soundbite policies of the governor and others, where instead of talking about what our community schools mean in terms of families, in terms of community center, in terms of the lifeblood of the community, when the discussion is always about how much is being spent on the school and not what we're actually getting from our schools, then you get these kinds of laws that are going to squeeze in this way. But you're absolutely right. The issue of the community vote is a significant piece of the criteria that the State Board of Education is supposed to use. I don't sit on the State Board of Education. I have watched some of those hearings, and I can very much understand how many of the people who have attended them feel like they were either speaking on deaf ears or weren't feeling like their viewpoints were being adequately heard by the State Board. I cannot speak for them. I think there are some state board members who are very concerned about these forced mergers, and it will be very interesting to see what the majority viewpoints on those opinions are, because I've talked to a couple of them, and my understanding is there's a very diverse set of viewpoints and a very significant split that may well find that many of these communities don't need to merge. But they have not come up with that answer yet.
You mentioned two options for communities that don't want to merge. One, they could implement legal action against the State Board of Education, or they might be able to take their case to the legislature and say, we don't want to merge and we hope you'll support us. How about a third option, which would be that the lawmakers would actually revisit this part sure. of Act 46 and say, maybe we don't think that the State Board of Education should be able to mandate mergers?
Well, I think that is part of the discussion. That's similar to the take it to the legislature. I mean, that's what happens. People talk with their legislators and the legislators bring that up. And I know some are already. And I think that's a healthy conversation. My opponent has said he would do that, except that I'm not sure he quite recognizes you don't get to do that as lieutenant governor. You don't get to introduce that legislation. But certainly the education committees will look at that legislation. I'm sure it will be introduced given the number of concerned communities out there talking with their legislators. And this is true of legislators in each of the three parties. This is one of those conversations that is geographically diverse across the state, politically diverse across the state, and it'll be very healthy to see what bills come forward and what that conversation is. And as Lieutenant Governor, I'll be assigning those bills to the committee and making sure they go to education for those conversations, as well as potentially government operations, as well as finance if it's related to taxes.
Would you support that approach?
Which approach?
Saying to the State Board of Education, actually having lawmakers in 2019 pass legislation that says, no, that mandatory merger language has got to come out of Act 46.
Well, it'll be after the fact. So they'll either be saying this merger or that merger is not going to be forced to go through. And I certainly encourage the conversation. I'm not an education expert, so I can't say in this town here, they had the best system going beforehand, and this is a terrible thing to force a merger. I'm not going to say I would either say yes, all of them, or no, none of them, because I think it's actually individual by individual in terms of the districts.
Let's talk to Michelle, who is calling from South Royalton. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. So I'm a teacher in the state of Vermont, as well as a parent and a taxpayer. From my inside point of view, I don't see Act 46 saving anybody any money. I feel like every time I turn around, we have a new administrator or new staff in the supervisory union. And I question whether or not there's actual hard data to say or to prove that we're actually saving money by consolidating, because I don't see it.
Well, it was pretty clear in the last education vote rounds in town meeting last year that the projected increase was going to be about 2.5% across the state, and it was 1.5%. And many school boards indicated they had found savings through administrative savings. It may not be the case in every district, and it may not be the case in yours. My understanding is those positive savings are starting to happen. Although I will also say, with respect to administrative turnover, one of the goals of Act 46 was to make it so that instead of a superintendent having 7 or 8 or 9 school boards to visit every 2 weeks and never being home at night, which tends to lead to burnout in your job, I'm not going to stay as this superintendent, I'm going to go somewhere else. That idea, if you start having single districts with fewer of those variety of board meetings that you've got to drive as much as an hour or two, would actually help those superintendents stay consistent in their jobs where you would not have that kind of turnover. Because I think you're absolutely right, Michelle. Turnover in superintendent positions and principal positions and administrative positions really leads to disruption and no savings at all, as well as no real clear direction for the school system. So I think that's a part that's sort of intangible, but it's one of the other goals of the law.
Today, we've been talking about healthcare. We've been talking about Act 46, water quality, all sorts of important issues facing the state of Vermont. What's an issue that we haven't talked about today and one that you don't think gets the kind of attention that it deserves, sort of a sleeper issue that as Lieutenant Governor, you'd like to really put a spotlight on this issue?
Well, it's something that I have talked about before, so I don't know that it's a complete sleeper, Bob, but and it's related to education. But, you know, we have huge costs in our social services, both outside our schools and inside our schools. We have, I think, 12 or 14 regional centers for our social services. So some families have to travel half an hour or 45 minutes just to access the social services in the state. And if you've got two working parents and one car, when is the person who's not at work supposed to take their family in or do the paperwork and learn how to get the added educational support they need or whatnot? And I would really like to see us go deep down at the ground level. And I brought this idea to the governor last summer, along with a couple other ideas, to say, you know, if you really want to save money in schools, it isn't even, as Michelle pointed out, it's not going to be huge savings from Act 46, but it's in these millions and tens of millions of dollars that we spend with these two separate programs. So you've got social services for kids from, you know, 0 to 5 happening outside the schools. And then when they come into the schools, they start receiving different social services in the schools and the paraeducators and others. Why not blend those two sets of services, reduce duplication, which would save money, create a better flow of services so we could work towards better outcomes for these kids? And that's something that is going to take a number of years of work. It's not a soundbite, save you money next year, let's start it this year, save you money next year, which is an unfortunate aspect of the two-year cycle. But that's where we have to look at long-term systems and really look at what is our education system trying to do and how is it working to prepare each kid to be the best they can be in the direction they want to go in work and in their community. And we're really not there anymore with all the standardized testing and everything else. I think there's far bigger overarching challenges in our schools than we're really talking about.
We've been talking with incumbent Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman about his bid to win a second term in office. Many thanks for coming on the program today and for agreeing to participate in a debate in about 2 weeks.
I'm looking forward to it, and thank you, Bob. Appreciate your time.